Hello and welcome, everyone. This is Dr. Rita Marie Loscalzo, and what we're talking about today is the great iodine controversy. And I would like you to leave here today knowing or feeling a good sense of whether you should be taking iodine or not, or whether you should be getting tested for this important nutrient. The reason I chose this topic is because I'm constantly bombarded with questions about iodine. Oh, I have Hashimoto's, or oh, I have this other autoimmune disease, and I was told I should not take iodine, and iodine is bad, and blah, blah, blah. And then others saying, like, take tons and tons of iodine. So I wanted to go through and share with you my research and give you ideas of how you will know personally for you whether iodine is a good idea or not. And that's what it's really all about. And that's why I'm here presenting all this information to you, is not to slam my ideas down your throat, but to share with you practical information and strategies so that you can make your own very informed health decisions. I think it's really important that all of our decisions come from information and not fear. So before we begin, I just want to remind you that this presentation isn't intended to replace a one-on-one relationship with a qualified healthcare professional, and it's certainly not medical advice. It's intended as me sharing information with you, information that I've gleaned from my own private practice, working with patients for over 22 years, from all the research that I do, from all the conferences I attend, and from experience just in my own life. So if you're working with a doctor, make sure that anything that I talk to you about today, that you run that by your practitioner and make sure that it's in the best interest of you and your health goals. So with that out of the way, let's begin. So let's start with, what the heck is iodine? What is it? So we know that it's a mineral, it's an essential element, and it's something that we need to be alive, to survive. It is part of, you'll see it on the periodic table, which is why I put this little cute picture. It's bright orange, and you'll see it. It has the atomic number at the top and the atomic weight at the bottom. And if this is smacking too much of chemistry from high school, just bear with me. It's just a little bit. But it's an element, it's a mineral. And a lot of the elements on our periodic table are essential to life. Calcium, magnesium, boron, iodine. And a lot of them are antagonistic to life. And we're going to talk to you about a few of those today that actually antagonize iodine. So iodine must be included in your diet, like the minerals do. Your body can't make iodine. It's part of a group called the halogen group on the periodic table. And it's way over to the right. It's the second or third to the end. And it's related to bromine, fluorine, chlorine. These are all iodine antagonists. And what does that mean? Well, we'll go through that in a little bit more detail. But if you're exposed to bromine, fluorine, and chlorine in your environment, and there's a lot of that exposure happening, that can antagonize the iodine because it can attach to the receptors in your body for iodine and be utilized instead of iodine, and then have a toxic effect on your body rather than a supportive and protective effect. So here we go. This is as detailed as, well, it's not as detailed as I get. I have another slide a little further on where I get a little detailed too. But this is the periodic table of the elements. If you studied high school not that long ago, it may be fresh in your mind if you're a chemist. If you have children in high school studying this, I see this all the time with my son who's taking chemistry. And I actually have some cute little takeoffs of the periodic table. I have a periodic table of the nuts and periodic table of the vegetables, and it's sitting on my wall in my kitchen. It's kind of different. It's laid out in this way, and it talks about those. It's really kind of cute. So I'm a geek when it comes to that sort of stuff. But you'll see this column way at the side where iodine sits, and it's the fourth one down on the second to the last column on the right-hand side, and it says iodine. Above it is bromine, above it is chlorine, and above it is fluorine. And if you recall anything from chemistry, as the elements go down the column, they increase in atomic weight. They're heavier, they're bigger. And iodine is the biggest of them all, which is why the bromine, chlorine, and fluorine have no problem getting in there and sneaking into the iodine receptors and wreaking havoc in your body. So let's talk about some of the reasons that we become iodine deficient. There is a big controversy as to whether we should supplement with iodine. But the truth of the matter is that we don't get enough in our food because our soils are depleted. We have a lot of antagonists in our environment. In addition to the fluorine, bromine, and chlorine that I talked about, toxins will compete with iodine receptors, and they can latch on to iodine receptors and displace them. Soils are depleted of iodine unless they're really close to the sea. The sea is abundant in iodine. But the land soil has become depleted. So that's another reason. Our land vegetables, our land foods are very poor sources of dietary iodine, unless you live by the sea. Iodine exposure to radioactivity affects iodine, like the fallouts, the nuclear fallout in Japan and other places where there have been nuclear accidents. There's radioactive iodine in the environment, and that too displaces the iodine on those receptors. In most places, the water is chlorinated and fluoridated. The chlorine is put in there to kill bacteria, to kill off whatever bad stuff is living in there, right? So we don't have this junky water coming into our house, which can be a good thing because we don't want bacteria, but we also don't want to be drinking chlorine. So it's a double-edged sword. There's also fluoridated water, and somebody got the bright idea, probably a company that had excess fluoride from industrial waste, decided that, wow, fluoride can protect your teeth and prevent cavities. And they convinced everybody that we should be taking fluoride for that. And yeah, fluoride in small amounts taken for specifically for tooth decay can be a helpful thing. But massively putting it in our water where there's no control over the amount that individuals would be consuming, I think is really irresponsible. It's a very irresponsible decision on the part of our so-called protectorates in the government. So chlorinated and fluoridated water, again, we bring those other halides in that displace iodine. Baked goods. If you buy bread, there's usually a dough conditioner, and that's made with bromine. An interesting fact I found out last year when I was at a seminar where we were talking about iodine historically and its uses and all, was that bread used to contain iodine as a dough conditioner. And for whatever reason, slipping my mind right now, they switched to bromine, and the bromine antagonizes iodine. There are lack of iodine-rich foods in the diet, just because the most predominant source in the diet would be sea vegetables. And unless you hang out with me and in my circles and in the circles that teach this sort of stuff, the raw food circles, the macrobiotic circles, you don't hear a lot of people or see a lot of people eating a lot of seaweed, sea vegetables, except when they go to the sushi restaurants. And so the solution to the iodine dilemma was to iodize the salt. Again, just like fluoridating the water, it's just putting the substance that we supposedly need, which we do need, into the supply of salt, and there's no control over how much people are going to have. If people eat a lot of salt or eat a lot of commercially baked crackers and cookies and chips and things and popcorn at the movies loaded with salt and iodized salt, you have no control. And so you could get into a situation where there's excessive iodine. But in fact, this way of protecting everybody, the iodized salt, it actually loses 100% of the iodine content after exposure to air for 4 weeks. So you put salt in a salt shaker. I don't know about you, but in our house, the salt shakers have little holes in them, right? So that salt is exposed to air. We don't use iodized salt. We use pure, unrefined sea salt. But that's the point. You lose it. So people are just not getting it, even though the government is trying to get it in there, you know, by creating this iodized salt thing and massively supplementing people. So that's why we become iodine deficient. And I promise you, I think this is almost the last look at chemistry. So if this kind of bugs you out, close your eyes for a few minutes. But I wanted to show you a picture of the halides. And they all look really similar. these are pictures of fluorine, which is the smallest, and iodine, which is the largest. And you could see that fluorine is very small. It has 9 protons and 10 neutrons, and it has an atomic weight of 18.9984032. So remember that number. It's important. No. Seriously, no. We probably had to memorize those things at some point in our life, but really we're trying to get the gist of it, that these things can displace iodine on the receptors for iodine, the functional receptors, and we're going to look at in a little bit where all those places are in the body that iodine is useful. So you read this from left across to right, wrap around, and then come back. Okay, so iodine is our central piece. That's the element that we need in our body, and the other ones just get in the way. Now, radioactive iodine is another thing. It has, if you look back at iodine here, it has an atomic weight of 127, pretty much. If you look at radioactive, it has a 131. So it's been combined with radioactive material, uranium, plutonium, whatever. And it's made to look differently. But here's the deal. The half-life of this stuff is 8 days, which means that in eight days, half of it is dissipated. But every exposure, so for example, you go in to get a test, like you very commonly there's scanning done on the thyroid where you're injected with radioactive iodine so that it does displace the iodine. So we know it displaces the iodine at the receptors because it's used clinically as an assessment tool. So somebody suspected that maybe they have a tumor or a cyst or cancer or something on their thyroid, they go in and they drink this iodine solution, or it's injected, this iodine solution, which is radioactive, displaces the iodine off of the thyroid and makes you feel pretty sick for a while there too, as a matter of fact. And it displaces it, so then when they do the scan, the thyroid lights up. They can see how much iodine and how big it is and what it looks like. So it's very commonly done. And the half-life is 8 days. So they say after somebody's had a test like this, this radioactivity can be transferred to other people. So they're not supposed to go around other people, not supposed to have sex, you know, not supposed to kiss your children, and certainly not supposed to get pregnant. So anyway, that's just a little bit of the science behind it. And here's a picture that I found of how far this travels. And this was from the Fukushima event that happened a couple of years back. And if you look right there where the explosion was, very red, very high concentration. But even then you get miles out and you're looking at huge concentrations of radioactive iodine spreading out. And some even say that it crosses the ocean and that traces of the radioactivity are found in California and the West Coast. So this is a serious problem. We have lots of exposures to things that disrupt iodine. So I want to take a look, in addition to what are the consequences of iodine deficiency, what's happening when we don't have enough iodine, I also want to take a look at why it's so important and what of our good functions are being disrupted when we don't have enough iodine. So consequences of iodine deficiency, well, hypothyroidism, low functioning thyroid. Why? We'll look in a minute and see how each thyroid hormone, T3, T4, are composed of iodine. T4 has 4 iodines, T3 has 3 iodines, and precursors to T4 and T3 are T2 and T1, which have 2 and 1. So if there's not enough iodine, your body just can't make thyroid hormones. So people who say, well, oh, I have Hashimoto's, I can't do iodine. And we'll talk about that in a bit, why that people say that. But they'll say, oh, it's been a rumor that goes around that you shouldn't take iodine, you shouldn't make sure you have iodine. Well, yeah, excess iodine has been shown to flare up Hashimoto's. Totally true. But excess is the key word here. The likelihood of you having excess iodine, unless you've been supplementing heavily for a long time, are pretty slim. So I think it's really wise that we test, especially in people who have Hashimoto's. I will never supplement somebody with iodine if they have Hashimoto's because I want to make sure. And I have not found any yet that were not deficient. They're all deficient. So the next thing on my list is goiter. And if you're looking at the screen and you see this picture, it looks really grotesque. This is a person's thyroid, her thyroid gland. The thyroid sits in your neck right in the middle. But excess iodine, there's a lot of other causes of goiter, but the main one is iodine deficiency. It could be iodine excess, but it's really rare. But look what happens. This isn't the common presentation, but I wanted to show you the extreme. But oftentimes you just look at somebody's neck and just see this swelling in the middle of their neck. That's something that needs to get checked out. The other piece though, you see how that thyroid, this woman's thyroid, it looks all bumpy, right? The other place that can get bumpy as a result of deficiency of iodine is your breasts. Not just in women either, but especially in women, because we have a lot of lymphatic tissue in our breasts. And those lymphatics get congested as a result of iodine deficiency. And if you've got these painful little lumpy bumpies on your breast, it's worthwhile for you to get tested to make sure that you don't have an iodine deficiency. It can also, it causes proliferation of tissue, so it can cause uterine fibroids. When I say proliferation of tissue, I mean overgrowth of fibrous tissue. So fibrocystic breasts, uterine fibroids. There were people who get really good results with iodine supplementation, not just taking it internally to get it systemically, which is important, but also applying it right there to the breast tissue to reduce fibrocystic breasts. It's very effective therapy. The other thing that can be done for uterine fibroids is applying the iodine vaginally and painting it up on the cervix so it gets up there into the uterus where it's needed the most. Phenomenal results. So the other things that it can cause are mental retardation and breast cancer. And one of the reasons that it causes breast cancer is because it affects the conversion between the types of estrogen. So without getting too far astray into the wonderful world of hormones, I will share with you that estrogen is not just a single hormone, as a lot of people think. Oh, I have estrogen or progesterone or testosterone. Estrogen is a family of hormones. The three main ones are coined E1, E2, E3, estradiol, estrone, and estriol. And estrogen gets a bad rap in that, oh, excess estrogen causes breast cancer. We have to be careful of it. And indeed, we do have to be careful about out-of-balance estrogen. And it's found in plastic mimickers to estrogen and plastics and all these things that can cause problems. But there's certain types of estrogens that are proliferative, meaning they cause growth, and there's others that suppress it. And the cancer suppressing type of estrogen is E3, which is estriol. Now, estriol is made by the conversion from the other two. And the only way that you can properly convert is in the presence of iodine. Iodine helps that conversion to happen. So when I look at 24-hour urine tests for people's steroid hormones to see what's going on there, I'll be looking at the ratios between estriol and estradiol and estrone. And if that ratio is too low, iodine is my top nutrient of choice. And you can reverse and get those numbers back into balance within several months of appropriate iodine supplementation. It doesn't mean going out and getting a multivitamin with 150 micrograms of iodine, which is considered the RDA. And a lot of docs are saying, no way, that's way too low to even support your thyroid, let alone all the other things that have to happen. But the breast cancer is a common occurrence when those estrogens get out of balance. And we can look at the various ratios and say, whoops, this person has an iodine deficiency. And the best way, we'll talk about some good testing for it in a little bit. But in the meantime, let's talk about a little bit more about the symptoms of iodine deficiency. Goiter, we talked about already. Fatigue, and this is true as a result of it affecting your thyroid gland. Increased levels of TSH, which is a thyroid hormone. Intolerance to cold, cold hands and feet. Foggy thinking, increased need for sleep. Sleeping does not necessarily take away the tiredness. You're still sleepy. Could be an iodine deficiency. Dry skin, thinning hair, and constipation. These can all be symptoms of iodine deficiency. These can also be symptoms of thyroid imbalance. Now, just because you have hypothyroidism doesn't mean that low iodine is the cause. It might be the cause. It might be a contributing factor aligned with other causes, but it might be not the cause at all. There's a lot of things that cause thyroid problems. So for years, people just thought, well, I've got low level of thyroid, I've got to take iodine. But in fact, that's not the only solution. So what else? Let's look at some other things. Let's look at the symptoms of iodine deficiency that are related to the lymphatic congestion that occurs when you're low on iodine. You can get skin irritation. You can get sore joints. You can get aching in your hands and feet that mimics arthritis. The cold hands and feet related to thyroid or not are related to lymphatic congestion. Swollen and sore breasts, fibrocystic breasts, even breast cancer, swollen belly, cellulite under the skin, sore throat, allergies, headaches, chronic colds, cysts of any kind, and accumulations of fibers or scar tissue. This can all be related to the iodine deficiency causing lymphatic congestion. It doesn't mean that if you have any of these symptoms that you are necessarily deficient in iodine, but it certainly says that you should rule it out. And I wouldn't recommend just going out and supplementing huge amounts of iodine without first testing. It could get into trouble, especially if you have an autoimmune disease. But small amounts or conservative amounts could be good, but it may not be solving the problem. It's kind of like when I talk to people about vitamin D. Most likely, you're not going to get harmed by taking a 5,000 IUs of vitamin D a day. The harm can come if the 5,000 isn't enough and you're continuing to suffer with vitamin D deficiency because you're only taking 5,000 and maybe you need more. You may have some of the metabolic things going on, genetic things going on. Same is true for iodine. If you decide, well, you know, I think I'm low in iodine, let me just supplement, and you go and you take like 400, 500 microgram dose that may be barely touching the surface. And then you're thinking, well, iodine mustn't be the problem. I must have to look elsewhere. When indeed iodine can be the problem. You're just not taking enough. So what are some of the benefits of iodine? What are some of the things that iodine gives us in our body? Well, it supports your immune system. It protects you from infection. Iodine used to be used very, very commonly as an antiseptic on the skin and still is. You put it right on the skin as a bacterial. Much better than taking those artificial synthetic antimicrobial things that they put on. So this is one way that it was used. It was also used to be used for water. When I was camping in the years ago, before we had those little nice portable filters we could take, we would take little iodine tablets. And if you had to drink out of a stream, then you would put the water in your container and you'd put this little iodine tablet in. Tasted awful, but it protected you from whatever critters and giardia, whatever else might have been going on there. So it's a very strong antimicrobial, very much supportive of the immune system. It also supports natural detoxification. And that is a double-edged sword because you'll see that when people get on high doses of iodine, they may not feel good and they think it's because they have an iodine allergy or an intolerance, when indeed that's not the issue. The issue is that iodine supports detoxification. And when you go in and you supplement with iodine, anything that's been any toxins or halides like bromine or chlorine or fluorine that have attached to themselves to the iodine receptors are being displaced now by the iodine. And then they go back into circulation and you may have some detox reactions. And I'll talk to you in a little bit about how you can avoid some of that. Of course, it supports thyroid function. Thyroid hormone is made with iodine, three of them or four, depending on whether you're looking at T3 or T4. And if you need more background on thyroid, you're on what's T4, what's T3, what's TSH, what does that mean? Go back in the library. The library has a thyroid presentation, which gives you more details. Supports optimal hormone function, like I just talked about with the estrogens, and making sure that you have enough of the protective estrogen, which is called estriol. It supports memory, energy, mood, and weight. And that's indirectly through the effect on thyroid, but also as a result of the effect on these other systems. And finally, supports breast tissue. Keeps the breast tissue nice and healthy. Lots of information. I've got some references for you if you want to dig deeper into how all this works and what some of the research is to support iodine in the use in breast cancer and fibrocystic breasts. And I'm not saying that if you have breast cancer, you should skip what the doctor says and go, you know, just get some iodine. And you need to be working with a practitioner who knows what they're doing and knows about the nutritional side of it, as well as the conventional side of it and what your risks are and you know, how bad things are. So this is a picture of the interrelationship with iodine and thyroid. Over on the far left, you'll see a molecule which is an amino acid called tyrosine. The second picture is thyroxin, which is also called T4. It's most commonly called T4, but it's also called thyroxin. And if you look, you'll see two of those, almost like two of those tyrosines put together. You've got the tyrosine at the bottom, and you've got two iodines attached to it. And then you have the top part of the tyrosine at the top. So there's four iodines attached to tyrosine plus a few other atoms stuck along with it. The triiodothyronine, which is T3. So if ever you're on a lab test, people always ask me, I can't find the T3 on my lab test. What's this thing called triiodothyronine? That's T3. So you know. That has three iodines. See, there's missing one over there. There's missing the top left one. See, there's only three. Now, there's something called reverse T3. And on average, about 20%, maybe between 10 and 20% of your T3, instead of getting your T4, gets converted to reverse T3 instead of T3. So in your body, your thyroid produces mostly T4, and that gets converted to T3, which is the active form. But about on average, 20% of that gets converted to reverse T3. And if the reverse T3 builds up, it's not going to be active. And if you have too much reverse T3 in relationship to T3, it's a problem. So you can see the main difference between T3 and reverse T3 is just it's flipped. The missing iodine compared to T4 is up on the upper left on the reverse T3, and it's on the lower left on the T3. So that's basically how iodine fits in. And I promise you, this is the last biochemistry thing. I wanted you to see where iodine fits in here. You basically have your food sources of iodine. The iodine is taken from there. Amino acids are taken from proteins, meat, fish, poultry, eggs, milk, nuts, seeds, greens, legumes. I didn't make this chart. I just found it. So it's missing a few things in my opinion. And in the digestive system, the protein gets broken down to amino acids. The iodine gets pulled out of those veggies and the foods. And then the iodine gets converted to iodide and then mixes with the tyrosine plus some oxygen. And it makes these single and double, like T1 and T2, and then those get converted to T3 and T4. You don't need to really focus on this or understand this. I just wanted to give you a sense of the progression, why it's so important to have iodine. So now, by now you're thinking, well, this stuff seems pretty good. I think, you know, it's a good nutrient to have, and it's not a good nutrient to be deficient in. So how do I know? How do I know if I'm iodine deficient? Well, there's some symptoms. We already talked about that, right? We talked about the low temperature and the cold hands and feet and the lumpy breasts and the fibroids. There's all sorts of things that can clue you in to, am I iodine deficient? So afterwards, take a look at the slides, print them out, take the slide that has all the symptoms and look to see, I have a lot of these. I might be iodine deficient. Another thing you could do is take your first morning temperature and compare it to your daytime temperature. But the first morning temperature is what's called the basal body temperature. If it's low, it suggests you might have a thyroid problem, which could suggest that you're iodine deficient. It doesn't mean that you necessarily are. The other way is thyroid labs. So the second and the third one are related to its effect on the thyroid. So you get a bunch of thyroid labs, you see that there's a problem. You still don't know if it's an iodine problem. And what you want to do, if you want to find out if there is a problem with iodine, is to do some testing. The one I most commonly use is called the 24-hour urinary iodine load test. And I have a slide that will take you through exactly how that process is done. But I want to take a few minutes to talk about something called the iodine spot test. And a lot of people ask me about this. And in fact, this is something I used to use a lot. So the jury's out as to how effective it is. It's certainly not as effective as the 24-hour urine test. And it's not quantitative, it's more qualitative. You're kind of looking at it and going, well, I think that it's fading. So basically you paint a square, a 1-inch square of iodine, liquid iodine, onto your skin, and then you watch it and you see how long it takes for it to disappear. And if it lasts for 24 hours or longer, you are unlikely to have an iodine deficiency. And if it lasts for 3 hours or less, you are very likely to have an iodine deficiency. And then in between, it's kind of, you know, hit or miss. There are a lot of things that can interfere. It could be that you've got wet, that it could be that there's more of an evaporation that happens. The liquid iodine evaporates into the air. So it's not considered the gold standard or very accurate, but it could be used as a starting point for guessing if you have iodine problems. So let's talk more about how to do an iodine load test, and then I'll give you a resource for where you can find it. So first thing you want to do is stop taking any iodine or iodine-containing foods for about 24 to 48 hours before you do the test. The day you're going to do the test, you make sure you read the instructions carefully in advance so you know what you're doing. It's a shame when you're doing a test and you get halfway through and realize you didn't read the instructions and then you just ruined the kit. So first thing you do is you get up in the morning and you discard your first morning urine. You just let it go. Then you take 4 tablets of a supplement called Ioterol. Ioterol is a combination of iodine and iodide. Each tablet has about 12.5 milligrams total of iodine between iodide and iodine. And if you take 4 of them, then basically you're getting 50 milligrams of iodine. So you take those 4 tablets and then you start collecting your urine. And you follow the directions, whatever the lab says about how often and how much, but you continue to test, take it, collect it all the way through to the next first morning urine. And people ask me, well, what happens if I get up during the night? That's right. You're going to pee into that thing no matter for a full 24 hours. So you discard your first morning urine on, say, Wednesday, and you test from the second morning urine all the way to the first morning urine on Thursday. Now, don't plan to do this on a day you have to get up at 3 a.m. to go catch a flight. Make it be on a normal day for you, because otherwise you may not get enough of the full 24 hours of urine. If the urine is over 3 liters, the lab will instruct you what to do. It may be that it's going to be too dilute. They'll have you look at the color. They may have you do it over again, but follow the instructions with the kit. There are a number of labs that do these, and you've got them on your slide. You've got Doctor's Data. There's one called FFP. Doctor's Data will only work through a provider. We have Doctor's Data up on our site at the drritamarie.com/lab testing page. We can order it for you, but quite frankly, I think you're better off going through Hakala, because Hakala is, they're a little bit cheaper, and they're very good at answering questions. Everybody that I've sent there has gone and talked to people, and they give you lots of information. They'll help you with the test. And then when the results get back, they'll give you a little bit of help with what it means. And then Labrix I haven't used yet, but I did meet the medical director of Labrix, Dr. Mead, at a recent conference. Very, very knowledgeable. And I may try their lab out as well to see how that one, theirs goes too. So you get your test back, and what happens if you decide that you find out that you are iodine deficient? Well, there's a number of protocols that you can use. So we're going to talk about protocols for correcting it supplementary and when you can use food. All right. So first of all, let's talk about how you know with the iodine load test if there's a problem. You've taken a 50 milligram load of iodine. It's a huge dose of iodine. If you've taken that dose, and when the results come back, you're going to get a pre and a post number. So actually, the instructions that I wrote there are if you're only getting the 1-24 hour. Let me just step back here. There's 2 ways you can do the iodine load test. One is you can get the preload number, and then you can compare it to the postload number. That's what I like to do. Some people just do the 24 hours and then compare it to norms. I'd much rather compare you on iodine and not on iodine. With a huge load like that, the expectation is that you are going to excrete at least 90% of it into your urine. So if you've excreted less than 90% into your urine, then you probably have an iodine deficiency. And the degree to which you are away from that 90% supports the degree of your iodine deficiency. So if you've got 86%, you probably could use to take a little extra iodine. Probably a little bit of food source is going to be helpful if you're not already on food source. And if you are already on food source, then a little supplementary. If your number is 50, it says you have a huge iodine deficiency. Okay? So in some cases, you may not be discarding the first morning urine. In the way that I prefer you to do it is you're not going to discard the first morning urine. You're going to collect the first morning urine, and they're going to give you a separate vial to put it in so you could get the pre and the post. The other option you have when you run the iodine load test is to also test the halides, the bromine, fluorine, chlorine. And different labs offer two of the three or all three, depending on which lab you use. And it'll add to the cost if you do this. But it's a good thing to know, because if you have a large dose of bromine, then we're going to know that, number one, you got to get rid of that bromine. That bromine is attached to the iodine receptors, because here's what happened, right? You had this bromine is in your system attached to the iodine receptors, and then you come in with a massive load of iodine. It displaces the bromine, and you're going to see extra bromine excreted in your urine. So especially if the bromine is higher on the second test than it was on the first test. Sometimes it's just high in general, which says that there's a pretty toxic load of bromine going on. So if you end up doing the halides and you see that one of the other halides is competing, then you're going to have to do a detoxification to help get rid of it and use bigger doses of iodine to help displace it. And you could end up having some detox symptoms. So I'm going to share with you some of the protocols and tell you where you can go to get more. So assuming that you have had the iodine load test and it shows that you're deficient, you're going to be taking some amount. And mostly you could check in with a practitioner on this. You could check in with the lab on this. Usually, I recommend if the person has a history of breast cancer or fibrocystic breasts, or currently has breast cancer, that they consider the 50 milligram dose. And that could be iodorol, which is a tablet, or it could be Lugol's, which is a liquid. Some people get digestive upset when they take Lugol's, the liquid, so they take it in the tablet form. Some people just don't like to take tablets because they have excipients and other things in them, but it also does protect your stomach from getting aggravated. So you'll have to determine what the best way for you to do. I know a lot of people who do the Lugol solution and they do just fine. So you're going to take that dose of iodine. What's recommended is that you start with small doses and then you can increase them. If you have some bromine or fluorine or chlorine bound to your receptors, or if you're toxic, what might happen as you increase your dose of iodine, you're going to see some symptoms. Here's what happens on the day of the test for some people. They take the test and they say, wow, I felt great the day I took the test. I had energy, I had mental clarity, my hands weren't cold. What does that mean? And I'll say, well, we'll find out when the test results get back, but most likely that means that you are iodine deficient and your body was just loving having that extra iodine to put to work. So that's a clue. If you do the iodine load test and you feel pretty awesome, it's a clue. If you don't feel awesome, it's not necessarily going to say that you don't need it. You'll have to wait for the results for that. But you can also feel awful. Why? If you've got a lot of other toxins bound to your iodine receptors and you go in there with 50 milligrams and you displace them, those toxins can enter circulation. And if you have impaired detox pathways, well, baby, watch out, because you may have a headache, you may feel nauseous, you may have aches or pains. You may have digestive issues. Whatever it might be, it's likely a detox reaction. So, in order to best utilize, this is a protocol that was put together, the 2007 Iodine Conference. There's a site, and I have it at the end. I have the site where you can go to, where you can find this protocol and everything you want to know if you want to really dig deep into iodine. Lots of research out there. So, along with the iodine, it's important to take some vitamin C, to extra vitamin C, 3,000 milligrams a day. More if you've got a lot of bromide. So you may need more to help you detox the bromide. Another thing that's recommended is 300 to 600 milligrams of magnesium. And they've found that in the form of oxide, glycinate, or citrate. I personally usually use glycinate or citrate over oxide, but any of them work. If you're in the B4 Begone program, you're probably already taking that much magnesium and that much vitamin C. 200 micrograms of selenium. Selenium is important for supporting iodine. It's also important for converting your thyroid hormone, so your T4, which is the inactive form, to T3. The other one that's been found to be helpful in this protocol is 500 milligrams of niacin, that's vitamin B3, twice a day. Now, the problem with 500 milligrams of niacin is the flush response. So I don't know how successful people are with doing this piece, but I took a 500 milligram dose of a regular niacin, not a niacinamide, and I was like, I was out in the sun, I was itchy, I was burning. It doesn't last long. That's a common response because the niacin's a vasodilator. But that's what this protocol includes, and I'm just sharing you this protocol, okay? I haven't actually done this protocol with anyone. I've just discovered this protocol recently, so I'm sharing this from more of an academic standpoint. I have done the vitamin C, the magnesium, selenium, and iodine. Those I have done together. I've done the B2 thiamine, but not in that dose. And then, of course, a B complex and all the other kinds of things can be helpful as well. You can also, if you get a bromine detox, so you're having really bad detox reactions. First of all, the recommendation is to slow it down and go really slowly with increasing the iodine. But on the other hand, there are ways to detox the bromine. And I'll talk about that in a second, but I want to make sure you're aware where your bromide exposure might be. You may be thinking, well, I drink pure water and I eat organic foods and I'm really careful, but you can still be getting exposure to bromide, because it's in the environment. Flame retardants, fire retardants, pajamas, mattresses, carpeting, electronics, furniture, car interiors. They're treated with PBDEs, which are fire retardants, and those contain bromine. Dough conditioners. Hopefully you're not eating bread. And if you are eating bread, you're making your own and you're making it in ways that don't contain gluten and all the other things. But people who eat bread, bromine in the dough conditioner. Hot tubs and swimming pools. Some commercial hot tubs and swimming pools and private ones too have gone with bromine over chlorine. Well, six of one, half a dozen of the other, bromine is toxic too. Plastics, pesticides that are in plastics, like even those that are used to make computers. And it's not that you have to be eating these things or touching these things. They're bromide dust that can come off of these things. And any baked goods and flours, even if they're not breads, and you might check those and make sure that they don't have something called potassium bromide. That might sound at first blush to be something good for you. Oh, potassium, that's needed. So soft drinks are another place, and medications. And the site that I'm going to give you a reference to has the lists of all the medications and all the different kinds of soft drinks. Hopefully you're not drinking soft drinks, and hopefully you're not on anything very necessary medications, but things like antacids and a lot of the over-the-counter medications have bromide in them. If you start to take iodine and you start to get any of the symptoms on this slide 20, it could be a sign that you're detoxing bromide. And there's some really weird kinds of symptoms. Eyelid and foot twitching, tingling in your hands or feet, dark and depressive thoughts, anxiety, sores on your mouth or tongue, acne, hair loss, brain fog. A lot of people have brain fog. Leg and hip ache, rash, metallic taste. This could also always be due to the bromide. Not always, but it can be due to bromide in your system. Bromine, bromide in your system. Metallic taste in your mouth, sinus ache, cheriangiomas, you know, those little raised like bumps on your skin that look like moles, but they're red. A runny nose, headache, lethargy, difficulty swallowing, body odor, unusual urine odor, dry mouth, frequent urination, diarrhea, constipation, vision changes, irritability, increased salivation, changes in your dreams, like really wild and vivid dreams, changes in your hormones, kidney pain, and breast tenderness. All of these can be a sign of bromide symptoms. And you also see those when you start to increase your iodine input. So there's a really good book that I recommend called The Iodine Crisis that lays a lot of this out, and this website that I'm going to give you the link to in just a bit so that you understand what might be going on. And if you're having some of these symptoms already, it may be related to bromide and exposure. So I'd be looking to see where that might be. So what are some of the detox strategies to get rid of the symptoms and get rid of the bromide quickly? Salt loading. I share that protocol. That's again on that website, and it was related to the conference, the iodine conference back in 2007. If you stop the iodine for 48 hours, it rests your kidneys, and so that can catch up and get rid of the bromide. You can reduce the iodine dose temporarily and then work back up. That's a really common thing to do and a very effective thing to do. You can take several grams of vitamin C throughout the day when you and the iodine companion nutrients, and that's the purpose of a lot of the iodine companion nutrients, is to increase the excretion of the bromine so that it's not circulating around. We do not want the bromine to stay in our bodies, so we do need to eliminate it. What we're talking here is when the elimination creates a set of symptoms. Drinking more water has been shown to be helpful, as well as 25 milligrams of zinc has been shown to be helpful. And here's the salt loading protocol for possible bromide side effects. So you basically take a quarter teaspoon of salt dissolved in a half a cup of warm water, and you drink it. And then you follow it immediately with 12 to 16 ounces of water. You repeat in 30 to 45 minutes if you need. So say you're getting some of these bromine symptoms, you get a headache, you're achy, you look at that thing, the metallic taste, you're taking iodine, this might be it. You can do this salt flush. Okay? And you may repeat, and you want to keep doing it until you're urinating like crazy. So this is going to stimulate you to pee more so that you can get this bromine out of your system. Okay. And this is just a note that I found that this project on they call the Iodine Investigation Project, those participants found like that they had better results when they used a half a teaspoon of salt instead of a quarter teaspoon. So now let's talk about food. There's a big controversy over whether we can get enough iodine in food, even if we are really, really careful. So let's address that. If you look at some of these sites and the iodine crisis and even David Brownstein stuff, they're talking, well, there's not enough. You can't really rely on the food. And indeed, if you have a severe iodine deficiency, I would be looking at iodine supplementation for sure. But if you have a mild deficiency, or once your deficiency has been resolved and you're looking for maintenance, you want to look at what are the foods, how do I eat? Because we don't want to be relying on supplements for our whole lives. We'd like to be able to get as much as we can from food. Well, top of the list is going to be sea vegetables, the highest concentration. And I have a chart in just a bit where you can see how much is in which of the sea vegetables. Seafoods, if you eat animal products, the seafoods that are highest in iodine are cod, sea bass, haddock, perch, shrimp, and tuna. I personally don't eat those things because I don't trust the sea. I don't trust the mercury, the contamination. I just don't trust it. Potato with a peel baked. That I thought was an interesting one, but I found it on several different lists, so it must be true. I am not a big fan of eating potato if you have glycemic issues, if you have blood sugar issues, if you have extra weight around your middle, it's a high glycemic food. But it's there. It was one of them. Certainly, I don't recommend cow's milk, but it does have a, you know, a little bit of iodine. Now, these other things have virtually no iodine if they're not listed. So milk has a little bit. But I don't recommend milk either because milk is, for a whole lot of reasons, mucus forming, acid forming, cross-reacts with gluten, highly allergenic, casein clogs up your system. Reason, lots of reasons not to drink milk. There is a whole presentation in the library to drink or not to drink milk. Turkey and chicken compared to other meats have a little bit. And we're progressively going down the scale. Beans have a little bit and egg has a little bit. But by far, sea vegetables are going to be your best source. So much iodine do we really need? Well, according to the RDA, which we don't always think of as in the most highest regard, that adult women, adults, men or women, need about 150 micrograms a day. And then pregnant or breastfeeding women need about 250 micrograms a day. When we look at the amount that's in one iodorol, that's 12.5 milligrams. That's, what, 20 times the amount? 40 times the amount? 250, that's 48. 48 times the amount that's in, that's the RDA for pregnant and lactating women. So I give you a few quotes from David Brownstein and a lot of other of the iodine researchers on what they think about this RDA. David Brownstein says, there's no way you can even support your thyroid gland on 150 micrograms, let alone the abundance of other things, let alone to combat the effects of radioactive iodine in the environment and to combat the effects of bromine and chlorine and fluorine in the environment. But this is just to give you an idea of the amount. This was from the World's Healthiest Foods, and they ranked the sources of iodine. A cup of yogurt had about 87 micrograms. Cow's milk from grass-fed cows had 28 micrograms. Eggs, 27 micrograms. And strawberries, 12.96. And these are all in, you know, reasonable servings about what people would eat. Maybe they'd eat two eggs and maybe they'd eat, you know, two cups of yogurt. But that's the amount. There's you'd have to eat a lot of these just to meet the RDA. So here's what it looks like for sea vegetables. And this is for per 7 grams, which is approximately a teaspoon. So if you powdered up your sea vegetables. So if you look at this, this is in milligrams. I should have put it in micrograms. And I'll say them in micrograms. But some of these got so big I couldn't say them. So you've got nori. It has 0.098 milligrams, which is 98 micrograms. So it's on par with the top food over there on the chart of the land vegetables, the land foods. Dulse has a 1.169 milligrams, which is 1,169 micrograms, which is four times the RDA for pregnant, over four times, the RDA for pregnant women and lactating women. Kelp has 3,170 micrograms or 3.17 milligrams, which is way higher. And this is in a teaspoon of kelp. Okay, a teaspoon of kelp powder. Wakame, 910 micrograms or that much in the terms of milligrams is 0.91. Arame, this is the biggest one, but there's a variety depending on where the arame has been grown, what kind of waters, et cetera. But it ranges from 7,000 to 39,000 micrograms. Whee! And hijiki is very modest with 2.8. That's 2,800 micrograms. So that's 10 times the RDA for pregnant and lactating women. So you can see that sea vegetables are huge. And a teaspoon, not that hard to get a teaspoon of sea vegetables a day, but even if you only did a half a teaspoon. I usually put about a half a teaspoon in a smoothie, and then I might put a half a teaspoon in an elixir, and then I might sprinkle it on, I definitely sprinkle it on my veggies. I put it in pretty much everything, so I'm getting a lot. Now, let's look at the numbers compared to the therapeutic ranges that we've talked about, like 50 milligrams. Well, you'd have to eat the arame, but you could do it. You could get that by eating 14 grams of arame a day. Not bad, eh? So It's interesting how much there is in sea vegetables. So you could overdose in sea vegetables if you're not deficient. And this is where the whole thing with the Hashimoto's and things come in, and people say, well, I took too much iodine and I had a problem. That's if you're just like overloading yourself with sea vegetables. Sure, you can run into problems, and definitely recommend getting the testing done. But you can see that the sea vegetables are a good source. And when I read that a book just saying blanketly, oh, they're not a good source, without actually sharing the tables and the charts, that's not a good source because people don't eat them. But if you eat them and you eat them abundantly. But if you have a very large deficiency and you've got a lot of bromine toxicity and you need to displace it, you might not be able to get enough in the sea vegetables to do that therapeutic regime. But certainly, if you have a very mild deficiency or you have a maintenance program that you're going on, sea vegetables are great. So I highly recommend that everybody start to incorporate sea vegetables. We have an awesome show, and it was actually a demo in the library just a few months ago on using sea vegetables. And this month's is going to be, again, more about the sea vegetables because it's so, so important, and it's something that people overlook. So fun stuff. And then when we do iodine supplementation, let's compare that to the foods, to the sea vegetables, right? So Lugol's, a 2% solution of Lugol's, which is the most common, two to four is common. It will have 1 milligram of iodine, 1.5 milligram of iodide, and then total of 2.5 milligrams. So when you take Lugol's, you might be taking 5 drops, 10 drops, up to, let's just say, 40 drops if you're doing the 50-gram dose, okay, if you have the 2%. But if you get the 10% solution, you have to take much less. A 10% solution, you only have to take 1 drop to get the 12.5 milligrams, which is the equivalent of an iodorol. And 4 drops would give you the 50 if you're doing, like, say, the iodine load test. So that's the story. Now, with iodine, like most minerals, it requires good stomach acid to be absorbed. Very important that you have good stomach acid. Iodine's very difficult to absorb. So it's a really good idea to be looking at your gut and looking at doing some bitter juices, dandelion juice, arugula juice, chewing on the bitters from your salads. The greens are super important because even though they don't have iodine in them, they're going to help improve your absorption of iodine. And let me just give you a few tidbits. These are some things from some of the researchers, the major researchers in iodine. So this was one from Dr. Donald Miller. He said women with goiters have been found to have a 3 times higher incidence of breast cancer. So that puts that connection together. A high intake of iodine is associated with low incidence of breast cancer and low intake with a high incidence of breast cancer. So if you want to protect those breasts of yours, iodine is key. Animal studies show that iodine prevents breast cancer, arguing for a causal association in these epidemiological findings. So epidemiological meaning there's not necessarily a causative, but there's so much evidence that Dr. Miller is saying there's some evidence for it being causative. How much do you need? Well, according to Dr. David Miller, iodine is needed in microgram amounts for the thyroid, milligram amounts for the breast and other tissues, and can be therapeutically used in gram amounts. Now, I'm not advising anybody use gram amounts. That's huge, unless you're under the care of a doctor like this who's a researcher who knows what they're doing. But the milligram amounts, I've definitely worked with people on. David Brownstein says that after testing over 500 patients, found that 94.7 of them had deficient iodine. And that's with doing the iodine load test. So how much are we eating? Well, according to Dr. Miller again, people in the U.S. consume an average of 250 micrograms of iodine a day. People in Japan consume more than 12 milligrams a day. That's a 50-fold increased amount. Why? They eat more sea vegetables. They eat a lot of sea vegetables over there and seafood. He also said that when you compare between the countries, it's disturbing because also the incidence of breast cancer in the U.S. is much higher. Japan, until recently, was the lowest, and U.S. was the highest. And look at the difference in the amount of iodine consumed. So this is what kind of irks me a bit when I hear all the iodophobia, as it's been termed, the fear of iodine. There have been some studies that show that, yes, excess iodine can flare up Hashimoto's because it increases the thyroid peroxidase antibody, which is this the subject of attack. But if you get the immune system under control, then you can have the best of both worlds. You can't stay away from iodine because you won't make enough thyroid hormone. And yeah, that won't give the antibodies anything to attack. But on the other hand, you're going to be walking around with hypothyroidism and need medication. And that would be just not a good thing to do. So don't be so fearful about it. Test it. Don't listen to the stuff that people say that if you have Hashimoto's, do not take iodine. And don't carelessly take it either. Go ahead and get yourself tested and take the amount that's indicated. And one of the things I'm going to tell you guys, it's important to repeat testing. You can't just test once and say, okay, I'm going to go on iodine. I'm going to stay on this dose for the rest of my life. That's very, very irresponsible. Repeat testing. So you go on a protocol, you do it for 3 months, you test again. It may take 4 times of testing over the course of a year to optimize your dose, but it's worth it. You see all the issues that happen when you're low in iodine. So here's 2 books. Iodine, Why You Need It and Why You Can't Live Without It is David Brownstein's book. And a more recent book is The Iodine Crisis. The David Brownstein book is written by an MD, one of the top researchers in the area of iodine. And then one of people who discovered Dr. Brownstein and had her own really serious illnesses cleared up by supplementing with iodine, wrote the book called The Iodine Crisis, which is geared more towards like a practical manual geared towards the layperson. Iodine, the book by Brownstein, can definitely be useful for the layperson, but it's also got a lot of clinical stuff geared for a practitioner. So here are some of your references. There's a really good article, I thought, on this lifespa.com, iodine deficiency was a really good article. That's at the top of your list. Then there's a paper from scientific literature as it pertains to Gulf War illnesses. There's paper by Dr. Abraham, Guy Abraham, on the interaction between vitamin C and iodine. There's the Abraham article, The Safe Use of Iodine, is very popular amongst the functional medicine crowd. There's another paper on iodine hypothesis, which ties in together the selenium and iodine in the breast cancer model. And then finally, Breast Cancer Choices Iodine Investigation Project Database. BreastCancerChoices.org. That's the very bottom one. So if you look at that very bottom one on your list, BreastCancerChoices.org, that will give you all kinds of great information about iodine. So that's the end of my formal presentation. We can take questions for about 15, 20 minutes if anybody has any questions. Otherwise, just really digest this information, read up on it if you're interested. If you have a history of breast cancer or family history of breast cancer or have breast cancer, I certainly recommend that you do your due diligence. Go to the Breast Cancer Choices website, take a look at the various papers that I've put out here. That iodine deficiency article by LifeSpa was really good. And that's that. So thank you very much for your kind attention.